Shall we play a game?
Oh.
I think I missed him.
Yeah, weird, isn't it? Love to. How about global thermonuclear war?
Wouldn't you prefer a good game of chess?
Later. Let's play global thermonuclear war.
Fine.
All right.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Ten, nine, eight, seven, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition, 210, we have a liftoff. We have a liftoff and it's lighting up the areas. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello, and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Books in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico. Today's topic is Ready Player One by Ernest Cline. And joining me once again to discuss this book with me is my regular co-host for the Auburn Wishbone Podcast, the sister show of this podcast, John Ringer. Welcome aboard the show again, John.
Thanks for having me, Van. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, it's always good to have you on here. We do our weekly during the season, bi-weekly non-season football show, but we have a lot of other interests that we share as well. And so tonight we're going to look for a little while here at this really cool novel. In fact, I would argue it's the best best fiction book that I've read probably in the last year at least. What are your thoughts sort of off the bat about this book?
I don't know if it's the best book I've read, but when I read it, I think it's the book that was written for me. Do you know what I'm saying? The book that if somebody custom wrote a book that appealed to people our age with our background, this is it.
Yeah, he's just a little – he's like 3 or 4 years younger than us. And so I'm not – you probably, but me, I know – I have a little more affinity for the late 70s, mid to late 70s, than he probably does, but just barely. He's almost entirely 80s, and the 80s were, I don't know if our listeners know, I think I'm like just about a year older than you, which is microscopic. but, you know, The 70s were when I was a little kid. The 80s were the decade I was a teenager. And you too.
That's right. I graduated from high school in the 80s and
went off to college. So, the 80s were basically my high school and college years and yours too. And so we were just the right age to be just wallowing in all the stuff that he wallows in this book, you know. So, somebody called it 80s reference porn, you know. but it's so much more than that, and that's one of the reasons I want to talk.
It really is.
I mean, anybody could make a Wikipedia page about the 80s. This is a story.
Mm-hmm. So, and a fun story.
Yeah, a brilliant story. It'd be a good story even without those things, which I think a lot of people get hung up on the references and don't see beyond that to the really good, very cinematic, which is ironic in a way, story we're going to get to. But I guess first we need to talk about what it is. Why don't you take a crack at sort of describing what this book is for people that maybe don't know. Oh, and before you do, one other thing. I'm not terribly well organized here, so I'm trying to make sure I get everything out of the way up front that needs to be. Our sort of plan is we're going to talk about the book in generalities for a little bit, and then we're going to announce that we're going to go into spoilers for the story. So if you haven't read the book, the first, 20 minutes or so here, you can pretty well listen to without too much worry. We might slip up and let something out, so be careful. But in the second half of the episode, we're going to dig around into what actually happens. So you might want to stop and go read the book before you come back.
That's right. And I would say our principal, Van, and I are violently opposed to book spoilers. So,
sure.
We're not going to let anything big slip. So, all right. So what is the book about? Here's my short, simple version, the way I think about it is it's in the future, 40 years or so in the future. And, it's kind of a not post-apocalyptic, but kind of head in that direction world. Food and energy are very scarce and things aren't good, but there's a huge global version of the internet that's kind of an interactive game called Oasis, which is a virtual reality game. And the founder of that game, when he was named Halliday,
mm-hmm.
and when he died, he left all his money in control of his company to the control of this game, which is called Oasis. He left that to whoever could solve a series of puzzles in the game. So it was like a quest to solve these clues, and then you would basically inherit millions of dollars in control of the game. And the way he did it is that Halliday grew up at the same time that we did, and he loved the 1980s, and so that he built into the game these clues that were based on 1980s pop culture things.
Mm-hmm.
So books, movies, video games, arcade games, role-playing games, music,
mm-hmm.
Commercials, all those kind of things were built into the story. And even, more obscure stuff, Japanese TV shows that came on, Saturday morning cartoon stuff like what's the one where the educational ones where they have that how a bill becomes a law and
the Schoolhouse Rock.
Schoolhouse Rock, that kind of stuff. So yeah. People that our age went through all that stuff, all those are built into the clues. But so there's a main character is a young man named Wade. Wade Watts, is that his name?
I think Wade Owen Watts. So he's W. Wade even his initials are like World of Warcraft.
Right, but Wade is a young man who's has a tough life. His parents are both died, and he lives with his aunt in a trailer, like in a vertical stack of 20 trailers.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes to school online in this Oasis world. They have virtual schools, and he is one of a series of people who've dedicated their life to this quest. And so he and some of his online friends go through the quest together. And meanwhile, one of the competing groups trying to solve the quest is kind of an evil corporation. And they want to win the quest because then they'll take control of this virtual world and monetize everything. And so they're kind of the bad guys in this. And so, but they have huge resources. They have thousands of people and millions of dollars and teams of people where he's just kind of a broke kid doing this on his own.
Mm-hmm.
But he's really dedicated. He spends every free minute, watching 80s movies and watching TV show reruns and playing through video game, classic arcade games, video games and stuff so that when he comes upon these puzzles, he can handle them. And so that's really what the story is about, of their adventures and trying to get through the challenges and solve the quest and ahead of the corporation, and it's really exciting and well done, and I think it's a fun story. Like you said, if it didn't have all the 80s pop culture references, it would be a fun story and a well-made one. But when you add those on top of it, mm-hmm. it just takes it to a whole other level.
Yeah.
And it makes it really fun.
Yeah, I'm going to move through some of our other points, but we can always go back and keep fleshing all this out. The author is Ernest Cline, who I didn't know a lot about before I listened to it. And I listened to it. It came out as a book in 2011, but it also is an audio book that's about 16 hours long, unabridged, read by Will Wheaton. And there's several really cool things about that, because Will Wheaton himself is like a cultural icon of the 80s. He's also developed this reputation as like to be a sci-fi computer geek, nowadays.
And he's in the book.
I was going to say, he even gets to read himself. He even gets to read Cline talking about him. And, you know, with his role as basically a villain on Big Bang Theory, he's sort of magnified, you know, his role in the sort of pop culture geek community. So he really was the perfect choice. And he does a great job reading it. The reason I even know about this book, I saw the paperback at Barnes & Noble for, you know, months. But the reason I didn't even pick it up. The reason I like it so much is because I guess Audible had or Amazon or somebody put it on sale for like $5 for the unabridged Will Wheaton audio of it. And I thought, well, I don't know if I'm ever going to read this or not, but I can't turn down $5 for a 16-hour audiobook. And so I bought it mainly just because it was a good deal. And I imagine it's more like $30 or $40 regularly, but it's worth it. It's totally worth it. So even if you've read the paperback, I recommend getting Will Wheaton's version, because he does a really great job with all the voices and all that sort of thing. He's very good with it. Ernest Klein, the author, I didn't know much about him, but he's written a couple of screenplays, including Fanboys. And this was very interesting. I saw an interview with him on Boing Boing, which is not a site I frequent very often. I'm not that much of a sort of a computer geek dude. That's just not really my thing. But I saw a video interview on there, and he made a very interesting point, which I think is hilarious, because when you understand, this property sold as a movie the day after it sold as a book. So before the book even came out on paper or electronically, it had already been sold as a movie. Now, what's ironic about that is that he makes his living, or at least used to make his living, writing screenplays. And he wanted to tell this story, but he decided that this story would not work as a screenplay or as a movie, because it has so many pop culture references, and no movie studio could ever get the rights to use all the pop culture references that he uses. So he wrote it as a novel specifically because he didn't think it could ever be a movie, and then he immediately sold it to Warner Brothers as a movie. Now, realize this happened in like 2010 that he sold it. And so it's 2014 as we record this, and it still hasn't made hardly any forward progress on being a movie. So we'll talk about the movie in a little bit. But my point here is it's just ironic that it was written specifically as a novel because he didn't think it could be a movie, and it's going to supposedly be a movie. So you talked a little bit about the setting. Well, we've touched on a little bit of this already. One of the things that I think that makes, and I don't want to go into too many specifics yet because we're still in the opening half. One of the things I think that makes this book so much fun is once you get into it, once the players start playing the game, they are faced with a series of puzzles, challenges. And each one of them, kind of like you alluded to, draws from some movie or game or video game or some combination. How did that strike you when you first read it?
Oh, I loved it. I mean, all this stuff, you know, really hit home to me because of growing up in the 80s and being a geeky kid. I mean, there's Dungeons and Dragons references, a lot of Star Wars references and Star Trek and, Ultron. I watched that TV show when I was a kid. There's, Transformers stuff. There's, stuff from later science fiction things in here, Firefly and things like that. But for the stuff from when I was a kid, also the video game stuff. I mean, the other thing is I know that, you know, the title comes from the screen in a video game when you walk into an arcade and you get put in a quarter, it says Ready Player One. And I know that's, you and I are the age when we actually spent time in arcades. Mm-hmm. I remember you played a little Galaga in your time.
Mm-hmm.
And, we used to spend a lot of time doing that. We've been in arcades. Van and I have blown a lot of money playing quarter video games at arcades long before Xboxes and all that stuff in the house. And so when the game, when he talks about, these different games that the players have to play, You know, I've played all those. I've played the stand-up version of those in an arcade, and I really appreciate that part of it.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. Yeah, I've put quite a few quarters into those old arcade games, and that was a big part of my teen years. And I think that there's no doubt. In fact, this is one of the maybe if there's been any criticism, let's put it away in the broader press, like the New York Times or something, when they reviewed this book, they just didn't get it right, and so they had issues with it in terms of the 80s references and all that. Well, that's to be expected. But in the fan press, right, in the fan media, with people mm-hmm. like us, their main complaint has been that it's too much video games to the detriment of all the other media. How do you react to that? Because I think that is the most, right?
Probably. I mean, there's a lot of other stuff in there too. But I don't have a problem with that. I play video games all the time. I grew up playing video games. I played arcade games. I had a, Apple II Plus, and I played games on that. And I played, Zork on my cousin's computer. And I played, games ever since then. And I played, online multiplayer games, and I played on the Xbox now. So, I don't have a problem with the fact that the video games are a big part of the story. And I think it really adds something. I mean, the other part is they're playing a giant video game is what they're doing when they're solving this quest. I mean, this is the other part I really enjoy about this is he's really spent some time thinking about what society would be like, with this kind of next generation internet stuff. And there's a lot of these tactile gloves and chairs and stuff they use when they're hooked in the internet all day. And the main character Wade is basically online for, 20 hours a day for months at a time. He never leaves this little apartment, and he gets food delivered, and he goes to unplugs himself, goes to sleep. He wakes up and, goes to the bathroom and exercises a little bit and gets right back in and goes back to it. So it's, but the author has really spent some time thinking about what culture would be like and how humans will interact with the kind of the next stage of the internet. I think that part was pretty interesting.
Yeah, and there's a lot of social commentary in that way that you get the sense that they've created this oasis. And this is something I'm going to touch on again at the end. They've created this oasis, but it's almost been to the detriment of the real world.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the world is in such decline, and he comes right out and says it. And by the way, he comes out and says things, and Wade Parzival, as well as the author speaking, I guess to some degree through him, Ernest Cline, that he actually says, the world is in decline, the country is in decline. They've been in an economic recession since now, since the one now just continues for 30 more years, and so, you get the sense that people have sort of turned to this video world. And in doing so, while it gave them a place of refuge that was nice, it just caused them to further neglect the real world. And a large theme that runs through this story is, yes, this online world is awesome and cool and fun and amazing, and here's all the great stuff you can do with it, like go to virtual school and do all these other great things. But on the other hand, you have to interact with the real world. You can't just leave the real world behind. I think that's a major theme that he hammers home, even at the very end. The whole idea that you can't neglect the real world.
That's right. And he talks about the damage to the environment that's going on. He talks about the damage to the economy. He talks about the global, how they ran out of fossil fuels. There's not enough energy to power stuff. So people, couldn't use cars as much. People had to move into these big clusters of people living around major cities and things, and how crime and society has kind of gotten out of control. So it is a lot of that. And they talked about specifically there's some Japanese characters in the story. He talked about how in Japan they referred to them as kind of the lost millions. There's kids that, never left their homes, never left their apartments. They stayed there, 24 hours a day doing online stuff. And so in some ways, when I read it, I'm like, wow, that would be so cool to go do that. And in other ways, I'm like, gosh, that would be just terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, to never be outside, never feel fresh air on your face, and, never go outside and be away from development and see the wide world, I think would be terrible.
Yeah, I think as with everything, it's moderation. You know, it makes me think of a couple of things. When I was the one sort of immersive online thing I've ever done like that was City of Heroes for a couple of years. And that's like the superhero game version of like World of Warcraft. And that was back in like 2004, 2005, 2006 were the years that I played it on and off. But I always limited myself to like no more than 2 hours a day because I wanted to live my life. I wanted to leave my apartment besides just going to work. I didn't want to stay up all night and be physically ill from not getting any sleep. And I was writing books. You know, I was starting my writing career. So I had very firm rules that I would only play that game no more than 2 hours, and then I would have to either go do something or close it and write, you know, or something like that. So I can certainly see the lure, but also the danger. And also it makes me think of, you know, Larry Niven forecasted stuff like this back in his known space books, you know, in Ringworld, and I guess especially in Ringworld Engineers. The main human character from Ringworld, the aliens that wanted him to explore the Ringworld for him the first time come back to get him like 20 years later, and he's a wirehead. Have you read in Ringworld Engineers?
It's been a long time.
Yeah, you remember Louis Wu? He was depressed about coming back from the Ringworld, and so he had gotten a thing installed in his head that gave him. It tickles his pleasure center with electricity, but people that do that end up just like they're on opium or something, like in the opium dens, wasting away. Sure. And so he had, while he was lucid, he had set his up with a timer so that after like a couple of hours, it would automatically click off, and he had to basically dismantle it to restart it, which made him, you know, wake back up and everything. So it's sort of the same thing with this, I think, you know, that it's in all things are fine in moderation.
That's right.
Before we get away from it, we're talking about the games. What were some of the arcade type games that you played a lot? And do any of them show up in the book?
Sure. Well, I mean, Joust is one that appears in the book, and I played the heck out of that. I mean, he plays Pac-Man.
Yeah.
Everybody plays Pac-Man, and it's, you know, I played Defender a lot. That he talks about that some in there. Some of the, you know, Battle Zone was one that one where you had the tank and you had the two joystick kind of things, like the tank controls. You would push them forward, or, you know, pull one left or right. That was kind of just the grid, black and white, green kind of outline environment. You drove around and shot other tanks that were just kind of outlined.
The vector graphics one.
Yes, and I think if people looked at those graphics now, they'd laugh. But that was really fun at the time. I played that, and he talks about that some. Trying to think of any other video games.
The ones that I played, some of them get mentioned, some of them don't. But my favorite ones I used to play back in the day. I mean, starting out with Space Invaders, which became Galaxian, which became Galaga, and I still play Galaga. I've got it on my iPad. Robotron was awesome, but there was only like one of those in my whole town, so I only got to play it very rarely. Defender and Stargate, which was basically the same thing. I loved that. That was that Williams game where you fly left to right, back and forth.
It was a great game.
I love Defender and Stargate. Tempest, that one gets a mention.
Oh, yeah.
I love Tempest.
That was a different. It had a trackball, didn't it?
It had a dial.
I knew it was a spin around thing.
Yeah, you spin around the end of a tunnel and you shoot down into a tunnel like three dimensionally. Right. But it's another one of those vector graphics games. Oh, and speaking of the original vector graphics game, Asteroids.
Oh yes.
Choo 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 choo. I just loved Asteroids. I was terrible at it, but it was interesting. It came along around the time of The Empire Strikes Back. You know, when they're flying all around the asteroid field. So that was fun. I never was big on I was never big on the running and jumping games. I didn't like Pac-Man. I didn't like Donkey Kong. I did have what was funny, at one point he mentions a bunch of video game consoles. And he mentions Intellivision and ColecoVision. And I was honestly thinking I was the last person on Earth that remembered ColecoVision.
Oh, no, I remember ColecoVision.
I had Zaxxon on it and Donkey Kong. Yeah, that was awesome, man. That was like the highest level of graphics we'd ever had at home.
I know.
Because Atari's graphics were pretty terrible.
They were. Adventure, you know, on the Atari 2600, we never had one at my house, but some of my friends had them. We played at their house. But Adventure, you know, Combat, the graphics were incredibly primitive on those, but they were fun.
I had the Atari before it was called 2600. They put the number on it when the 5200 came out, so they could say this is the cheap one, this is the expensive one. Nobody ever really bought the 5200. It was VHS versus Betamax. People go for the lesser quality thing that's cheaper rather than the more quality thing that's more expensive. But yeah, I had Atari before it was 2600. I actually had a Pong game, and I had Intellivision. So. And television was awesome. Did you ever see the football game on Atari?
Oh, yeah, I played that.
It's like six little squares bumping into each other in slow motion.
That was great.
The little handheld thing that you used with you put a 9-volt battery in, that had better graphics than Atari football.
Oh, yeah.
A little bit more about the general situation before we get into this actual story a little bit. It's interesting in that it gives you kind of what I always like, which is a good caper story with cohorts sometimes working together. I mean, I'm a sucker for the old going to do a mission and maybe I got a team. And as the story goes along, and I don't think it's a spoiler to say that, you know, you meet these various characters that are involved in trying to solve the mystery, right? Solve the puzzle. And so it's kind of neat because it almost becomes like a, in some ways, almost like an Ocean's 11, you know, or which also touches in like, you know, the Fellowship going through the mountain in Lord of the Rings. You know, anytime you put a little group together with specialists at different things and you set them on a mission, I love that. Force 10 from Navarone. I mean, any kind of a mission story, you know, any kind of a mission story I enjoy. And this kind of takes on that atmosphere kind of in the second half, more or less, once he's kind of set everything up.
It does. And also because at the first half, they're rivals.
Yeah,
and they're battling to get the clues before each other. Yeah. The other thing that we failed to mention in this is there's a global scoreboard that anybody in the world can see at any time, and it shows who has the most points in this quest game. And so when you find one of these big clues and do it, you get points, and everybody knows that you got it with your name.
Yeah.
And so you know, it's a big deal when these top characters are competing for these things and they're trying to find them and they're competing with each other because that's how they really come into contact with each other. They're all on this kind of top 10 scoreboard thing.
The high five, they call them, yeah. And then there's – did we mention IOI?
I mentioned them as kind of this faceless corporation that
– Yeah. Well, yeah. You've almost got like Apple and Microsoft or something. Where, you know, one company's more user friendly and the other is more like out to get every penny. And I'm not saying that's Apple, Microsoft, but it's like two big electronics companies are the idea. And basically the guys that run IOI, the bad guy company, they've been trying to take over the Oasis company for years and failing, and they figure this is their big chance. And so they essentially bring in all these people to play for them, and you have to sign a contract that if you win, you'll give it all to the company.
Mm-hmm. And in return, you can make a lot of money. You get to play the game for free all the time, and
you get room and board basically in an era when everybody's, you know, homeless and starving and everything. So
that's right.
But everybody hates them. And what's funny is there's a little matrix. There's a little bit of a matrix thing to it, where they all have the same avatar.
It is. And the all avatars look the same for this company, and the only difference is their ID number.
Yeah, instead of a name like Parzival or Artemis, they are 655321, 655. They're called the Sixers because their first digit is always a six from their company ID number. And everybody hates the Sixers, so it's basically the high five versus the Sixers, I guess, more or less.
That's right. Well, and it ends up being kind of everybody who's kind of not part of the corporation and is on the quest, and they call themselves
Gunters.
Questers, Gunters. They call themselves Gunters. They're the people that are on the quest. And so it's basically, it becomes all of them against the corporation at some point.
Yeah, because it's from Egg Hunters. And right. Where did it go? There was one other thing I was going to mention. Oh, yeah. That Halliday, James Halliday, the sort of he's based on sort of a Howard Hughes, Richard Garriott, Steve Jobs, you know, he's the sort of reclusive, I don't know if Jobs is reclusive, but he's sort of the reclusive, almost autistic in a way, you know, really socially inept guy who's a genius that programmed the whole Oasis. And we've called it a game, but it's, you know, it's not really a game. It's really almost like Second Life or, it's like just, it basically becomes the internet. It's like the whole internet is the Oasis.
But it's also, it's that, but it's also completely virtual reality.
Yeah.
So you're it's in completely it. Immersive experience where you, you know, you're running around doing stuff, you know, and it's really, you know, it's all very real to you.
Right, right. And the better equipment you have, the more real it is, right? You put on these haptic suits.
Right.
That you actually feel everything.
Yes. And at one point, Wade has the real high tech gear. You'd even like, they have a machine that puts out different smells.
Smells.
You can smell the stuff. Yeah, I thought that was great.
And I thought it was funny that he said that some hackers would like make things smell really bad just so that if you had a nice smell tower, it would put out a stinky smell. So your smart thing is when you go into a place you've never been before, turn your tower off.
But so the other part we need to finish describing about the setting here is, so imagine like the universe is out there, but it's one that's artificially created. So there's whole planets based on books, TV shows, movies, video games. There's whole planets that, you know, are based on Hoth. There's planets Tatooine. There's planets based on Star Trek planets. There's whole planets based on video games. There's planets based on the settings from different books and the towns in them. You know, there's whole planets that are like people's personal planets. They can do whatever they want to with them. There's planets from different movies, different versions of society at different periods of time. And some planets are, you know, friendly, like safe zones, and some are like player versus player zones where you go in there, anybody can fight you. And if you die, then, you know, in the game, you basically start over.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have any of your stuff, and you're back at level one or whatever without your clues and everything. So you don't want to die. So if you go and you go into these PvP areas, the corporation can kill you and basically take you out. And so, you know, Wade and the other top characters go through all these quests to get up to level 99, which is the highest, and they accrue all this really great, awesome gear, both magic stuff and science fiction stuff. So that part is awesome to me. I always love that the stuff they accrue along the way.
And on the other hand, if you're a very low-level character, kind of like Wade is at the beginning, because he's just a high school student, basically, you can't even go from one planet to another because there's basically two ways to travel around. You can get like a spaceship, but that's expensive, or you can teleport, but teleportation costs a lot of money too, to your character, either in terms of game money or actual money or whatever. So
real money.
Yeah.
And
so that's
Wade doesn't have any money, so he's stuck on the school planet at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and things really work out very interestingly in terms of the plot that way, because he otherwise wouldn't have any way to participate. You know, Halliday was very smart, and by extension, Ernest Cline was very smart in the way he put it together to give, you know, even poor people a chance, basically, if they can figure it out. So you want to go ahead and move into our spoilers now and kind of dissect the story a little bit?
Sure.
Okay, so we are now alert.
Ooh, warning, warning, warning.
We are now moving into the spoiler zone. So again, if you haven't read it or listened to it, totally go out, get a copy, audio or paperback or hardcover, whatever, and read it, and then come back and listen, because we're going to talk now for a little bit about some more specifics. All right. So there's just so many things that we can talk about in it, and I want to make sure we hit on all the high points or as many as we can. Let's kind of run through some of the characters and what we think about them now that we can kind of reveal stuff about them. Wade is Parzival.
Parzival is his username in the game.
Because Parzival the Knight, I guess, found the Holy Grail, so that was a pretty clever way to go on that. And his best friend is H.
H.
A-E-C-H, H. What did you think about H?
I had kind of this love-hate thing with H through the book. It's kind of cool for a while, and then I really didn't like him, and then ends up being okay for a while.
I figured that when these people start, and toward the end, of course, the people start meeting each other in real life. And by the end, everybody that's still alive meets everybody else in real life, I think. Do they meet Shoto? I guess they do, but
they do.
It's just not very. It's no big deal. but yeah, the supposedly big reveal is that Wade's old buddy, white guy H, is actually H is for Helen Harris, who is not only a woman, not only an African American woman, but a lesbian African American woman who's been his white guy best buddy for years. And I thought that was very interesting because it, you had to see coming that somebody was going to be something other than they were, and he wasn't going to make Artemis like a 70-year-old, chubby dude, right? Even though he toys with that throughout the story that
sure
she could be, some guy in his basement, but I felt like if anybody was going to be something other than what they were, it had to be H, because it was kind of redundant to have another white guy alongside Wade. So I thought that was pretty neat. I thought H turned out to be a pretty cool character. Now, the one I had problems with that everybody else seems to love is Artemis. What did you think about Artemis?
She was an interesting character. She was his rival at the beginning, and they end up having a relationship, and then it kind of gets bad. And then she had some birthmarks on her face, and it disfigured her, and so she was very self-conscious about it, and so she was really mad at him for, at one point he hacks into the IOI corporation and sees her picture or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And she gets mad at him about that. So, I guess I can understand that a little bit. So, I don't know. What did you think?
Well, I understand where she's coming from. And she is incredibly defensive and self-conscious. But that just annoyed me to death. I know he was like all smitten and chasing her around like a puppy the whole time after they first meet. But it just seems like she's so annoying with her defensiveness and her insecurity and everything. That, like when he basically risks his life and his freedom to save their lives. And everybody else is like, Wade, you're awesome. And she's like, did you see my picture? It's like, shut up. I just want to reach through and smack her in the head. Like, I just found her incredibly annoying. Even at the end, everybody else is like, yay, yay, yay. And she's just like, eh. He says, I'm going to give everybody else a share of the money. And they're like, oh, you're so great, Wade. You're so awesome. And she's like, you're not really going to do that. And I'm just like, come on. She makes him like go online and promise everybody in the universe that he's going to give them a share of the money. I thought, you know what? I mean, he saved your life. He doesn't really owe you anything else at all. So I just have never understood from the minute I started all this and started reading up on people's views. She's so popular. People do pictures of her and everything. I just don't like her. I liked H way more than Artemis. So,
In terms of the gameplay, in the game, Artemis does cool stuff.
Yeah.
She has, she runs around and defeats the puzzles and stuff in a cool way. So I think that's part of it.
In some ways ahead of him. I mean, she leads while. The first time that they meet is awesome.
Yes.
Because she's way more powerful than him at first, and he doesn't know at the moment they meet if it's player versus player where they are. And so he's scared to death that if he lets on that he's got one of the keys, she's just going to kill him and take it.
Yep.
And so he's like, oh, I'm just, Yeah, I lost. Oh, sucks for me. Well, I guess I'll go. And she just keeps talking to him, and he's like, well, she's so cool, I want to talk to her, but I don't want her to know that I defeated the game, you know, because she's been coming down there for weeks and losing, and he goes down there the first time and wins, and he's just about to get away, right? And she looks at the leaderboard, and it's always been like 0000, and all of a sudden it's like Parzival, 10,000 or whatever, and she's like, wait a minute! You did it the first time? So that was pretty awesome. That was the scene that really got me hooked, that I definitely wanted to keep going, was when they're down there in the first sort of dungeon.
Well, and it was, let's be clear, if you played Dungeons & Dragons, it was Tomb of Horrors, which is a classic module that I played many times and I'm very familiar with. And so that was exciting to me to see him use the recreation from that. And so Parzival goes in there, defeats the traps and stuff because he's read the dungeon too. Mm-hmm. And so he knows what's coming. And so he's prepared for all the monsters and the traps. And then at the end, because we're in the spoiler zone now, the Lich is the monster at the end, and he has to play him in a real game of Joust.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And it is so cool.
Because he thinks he's going to have to fight him. But, yes. But again, this is where Halliday, Anorak, is so clever. He puts the first dungeon, the first puzzle, on the planet that the students are on, so that even if they're dirt poor, they can still get to it.
Mm-hmm.
And he makes it something that they have to use a skill rather than just being a high level with a lot of experience points and hit points and super weapons. So I thought it was very clever how Halliday and, again, by extension, Klein structured each quest or each puzzle so that anybody at that stage would have a fair chance at it. It didn't lean toward, you know, the big characters or the rich characters or the corporate characters. I thought that was very, very good.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, I didn't think about it that way, but it's true.
It did annoy me that it was Joust, though, because I hated Joust. I hated that game, man.
It's like Joust, the original Flappy Bird.
I guess so. I've never played Flappy Bird, but I've heard my daughter talk about it. I can't remember now. It's been a few days. And Shoto, they're the two Japanese brothers who aren't brothers. And they're interesting, I guess, because they provide several things. You need somebody to get killed for the story to advance. And so you got kind of these, you know, with them, you're like, well, one of them's kind of redundant. And then you realize, oh, that's why they're redundant, because, you know, you need somebody.
Well, and they show like how sinister the corporation is, too, because they're not just going to do stuff in the game. They'll find you in real life and kill you.
Yeah, pitch you over the balcony and then put videos of it online. And which reminds me, that's the other thing that I thought was so clever. And this is what, again, what totally sucked me in, and I just didn't want to stop listening to it, to the audiobook, was that they reach a point later on where the Sixers get to one of the gates first, and they put an impenetrable force field around that area on that planet. And everybody, well, like all the big clans, just like in Warcraft or something, all the big clans come, and they're dropping nukes on it and stuff, and they can't get through it. And Wade realizes, A, he's got to figure out how to get through this force field, and B, and maybe he figures this out later on, but one way or another, this becomes part of it, is that there's incriminating evidence about IOI, the company, and they're out to kill him and the other, you know, individual players. And so he actually, describe what he does. I just thought this was awesome, this section of the book.
Well, this is the kind of a funny view of the future, how society works, but the way society works at that time is if you go into a debt to a corporation, they can force you into indentured servitude, basically.
Yeah.
And so he sets up a bunch of stuff where he, freezes all his online stuff and puts it in a kind of secure mode and puts all his defenses on high. And then he basically sets up a fake name and everything where he gets himself arrested by the IOI Corporation. And he had bought all these codes that will allow him to go into their back doors and their systems. So once they bring him in as an indentured servant and force him to work in their corporate headquarters, Then he uses these codes at nighttime to hack into their system and get their data. Mm-hmm. And so he gets a bunch of data about what they're doing, about what they know about the quest and everything. And then he sets up basically kind of a thing inside their network that triggers at a certain point and brings down the force field.
And I got to say, what he does, this is going to sound crazy, but I've got to say this. But this happens a lot. When you write enough books and stuff, people do your ideas even after you did it. They don't know. What he does to bring down the force field is almost exactly what I have Ezra Brakis do in Stellarax to go after the world mind, the big living Death Star. He has a robot with an antimatter bomb inside the thing. That's exactly what I do in Stellarax. I'm reading that going, oh my goodness, you got to be kidding. This is and it's funny, I looked at the date, and this book was published in 2011, and Stellarax was published in 2011. So, we can't either one of us say the other one ripped. I would never think he ripped me off, obviously, but it's just amazing. You know, these things just happen. So, that was very familiar to me, having a robot inside of a structure carrying an antimatter bomb right into the interior of it. That was exactly. So, I also wanted to mention that for people that have missed it, that because I am a European soccer fan, I used to listen to World Soccer Daily, and the English guy that was the host of that show, I don't remember his name now, he would talk about anoraking. So to the British, anorak, you know, it's like a coat. It's like a hoodie or something.
Right.
And it's a slang term in Britain for like somebody who just totally geeks out on something to the point that their entire life is consumed with just geeking out on this one thing. So like in soccer terms, it's somebody who knows all the statistics and can just like recite all the numbers like Rain Man, you know. And so I thought it was interesting that the wizard name for the main, you know, for the rich James Halliday that created the Oasis was Anorak. I didn't know if people just thought that was a wizard name like Gandalf or something. No, it actually means uber geek. So even everything is a reference. Everything, even things you don't think are a reference. So what about the big finale? We're going to run out of time in a little bit, so let's go ahead and move on to the big finale.
You run through the brief finale quickly. I've talked a lot here at this point.
Oh, well, just the, you get to the force field down, and a couple of things. One is that when you got through the last gate, you got to pick out a giant robot as your own to kind of stash in your inventory. And I was loving that because a lot of them were like Japanese robots and things I never knew anything about. I'd maybe heard of, but I didn't know anything about. But at one point, they have like the Shogun Warriors.
Yep.
And when Raydeen, he talks about Raydeen, I'm like, yep. Oh, yeah. I had Raydeen.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And then when the bionic monster, now he calls it Mecha Godzilla, but when I was a kid, it was a bionic monster, the big robot Godzilla. Mm-hmm. And that becomes like the main bad guy's robot. So that was pretty cool because it's huge and scary and everything and stomps on everything else. So what was there a robot you would have taken that you thought was really cool?
Raydeen was up there.
Yeah.
I loved him. I don't know. That's a tough one.
See, it was funny. They had different ones. There was like a TV show or something that had different ones than were available as toys. I had Raydeen, and I had Mazinga, and I had the Godzilla. That Godzilla that was the same size as the Shogun Warriors. Mm-hmm. Those were like the 2.5-3 foot tall ones, you know. Man, yep. Those were fun at Christmas. And those were like the favorite presents I ever got as a kid were those big Shogun Warriors. And, you know, in the comics, they had Combatra, but they never made a big toy out of Combatra, the red one. Mm-hmm. And there was also, I think, like Dangard Ace or something, and they didn't have a big toy of that one, but they didn't. But anyway, but they had Mazinga, and they never used Mazinga in the comics or anything. So I don't know. Anyway, I like the big robots. And then and we get the big battle there. And then it kind of
uses the special Ultron thing. Ultron was a Japanese TV show.
You mean Voltron?
That where he turns into he pushes the little power up thing.
Oh, Ultraman.
Ultraman.
Yeah, Ultraman.
Ultraman for 3 minutes. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
The Japanese TV show from back then where he it used to come on Saturday morning where he turns into like a 150 foot tall guy with metal skin, and he does this little cross kind of thing with his hands and it shoots a ray out. We used to run around the yard and play that all the time.
Yeah, I did never see a mention of Jet Jaguar. That was the one from like Godzilla versus Megalon or something.
Sure.
Yeah, that's what people complain. They're like, you know, I wish that my other favorite reference had been in it. I'm like, well, you can't. How many can you fit in there? You know, they fit quite a few references, but yeah, I guess ultimately it comes down to trying to open the last gate, and that puzzle and one of the others is where you have to act out a movie, and one of them was you had to act out War Games.
Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting because Mark Buskett and I are going to be talking about War Games on this show, on this series coming up in a couple of weeks, probably 3 or 4 weeks. We're going to do Cold War movies of the 80s, the Reagan era Cold War movies. So we're going to be talking about that. And another one I think had to act out like Monty Python and the Holy Grail, maybe.
Parts of that. Yep.
Yeah. So you had to know like every line of your character. It was just. I'm going, how do these people, how does he know all this? He's like, well, I only watched that movie 17 times in the last month. I'm thinking, how do you have time to watch?
Well, that's all they did. Again, all these people are doing is travel around this virtual world, and at the same time, they have a second screen open while they're watching, you know, Monty Python, or they're watching reruns of these TV shows or movies and listening to music. And so they just absorb it all constantly because they know they're going to need to know this stuff.
Yeah, well, and it worked out. I like how the test that you're going through to win this game and take control, because the prize is not just the money, it's taking control of the Oasis as like the CEO.
That's
and
right.
So rather than test to see who's the best CEO, it basically tests to see who spent their entire life rewatching War Games 75 times. I mean, I guess that's what they consider that's what Anorak considered was, you know, the prime qualification for being CEO of his company was knowing all the dialogue to War Games.
New so, CEO material, man.
Golly. Well, okay, well, so that's kind of how it plays out, and then we get the sort of denouement at the end where they meet in real life and they meet Og, which is kind of like the Wozniak to Anorak's Jobs, you know, that helps them a little bit. What did you think about the ending overall?
I liked it. I mean, it's, you know, it's such a fun book that the ending is a little bit of a letdown when it's over. So.
Yeah, that's true.
What did you think?
Yeah. I mean, I really wished he had just told Artemis at the end, you're too annoying. Yeah. I'm going to find somebody that's nice to me and not mean to me. But other than that, no. And it's interesting because at the end, they show Anorak's ghost, basically, right, in the machine, which I think he quotes, which is in a Police album from 1981 or 82. Anorak comes out and tells him, here's the big button that self-destructs the entire Oasis. Now, you're the only person that knows about it. Now, see, I was wondering if there was like an earlier version of this book where Ernest Cline planned to have Wade blow up the Oasis at the end. In other words, he decides that we need to get back to saving the planet, not being in the online world. And so when Anorak gives him the ability to blow it up, he blows it up. Did you feel that in any way?
I thought about it that it might be a thing where this is the end of it. Where I don't know if Wade would choose that, but it might have been what happened at the end is
right. The only way to save everything, or, yeah.
So,
but he went with the lower key answer, which is that Wade just decides for himself, I should spend less time on the Oasis, basically in the Oasis.
Right.
So, and that's fine. Do you see any kind of a sequel possibility coming out of that? Because here's what I see the sequel being called. The sequel would involve the big red button, and instead of being called Ready Player One, it would be called Game Over. No?
Could be. I mean, what would it be like the, you know, evil people take over the thing and the only way to save the thing he loves is destroy it? Or
yeah, kind of a, the only way to save it, destroy it. Kind of a Vietnam War mentality kind of thing there. Blow up the village. It seemed like he left that hanging there if he ever wanted to do it, you know, that Wade knows how to blow it all up and nobody else does. So if it ever came to that, he could pull the plug. But maybe he could back it up somewhere, you know, and he can go in and edit it and remove the bad guys or something. So, oh well. So what do you think about a movie? It's sold to Warner Brothers, and one of the words I heard is that Warner was the one he chose because they had the most licensing rights from the book.
Well, and that's the bit, like you talked about it. I don't know what percentage of licensing rights they have. Maybe it's 25% of the stuff in this book.
Maybe.
But there's no way the movie's going to get made with even 50% of the licensing rights to the stuff in the book. They're just not going to get it all.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to all the movies and the music, there's a whole, one of the whole clues involves Rush music, which yep. was awesome. I mean, I saw Rush in concert in the 80s and it was great. Yeah. So I love that part.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that, the video games, the TV shows, the movies, there's no way they're going to get the rights to use all that footage and then mess with it the way you have to for this movie to work. So,
yeah.
That's going to be the tough part is that people, but you can imagine though, if they do the movie in the way where they get a lot of those rights and they can bring in a ton of 80s, nostalgia stuff into a really cool action science fiction story.
Mm-hmm.
Where, I mean, at one point the guy's, you know, he's on his super secret asteroid base. He's got an X-Wing TIE fighter. He's got the ship from Firefly. He's got 25 different lightsabers. He's got katanas. Lord. He's got magic swords. He's got magic rings. He's got armor. He's got guns. He's got missiles.
Yeah.
He's got a talking AI thing that's max headroom. You know.
Exactly.
And he's got the DeLorean from Back to the Future.
Yeah.
And so people, you know, would go bonkers about all that stuff in one place together.
Yeah.
And love that stuff. So I think that, you know, the idea that you could bring all that together and put it in one thing and have fun with it is what makes this such a cool story.
And it,
so
yeah.
If he could pull it off, I think the nostalgia factor for the 80s stuff plus the kind of the you know, the cool nature of the story would make it successful.
And I guess the one saving grace that he couldn't use everything is that he might have to change the puzzles and the mm-hmm. gates and everything, which would be fun for us all over again. Because if the
sure.
if we go into it and we already know all the answers, it's not going to be quite as fun. Somebody I saw on another show said that, you know, as far as casting, the person you've got to have cast, and whoever, no matter who else, Og, the sort of Wozniak guy who helps him a little bit that's still alive, he's got to be Jeff Bridges.
Oh, jeez. I don't know about that.
You know, kind of the Big Lebowski Jeff Bridges, mm-hmm. you know. But I don't know. Well, all right. Well, this was fun. Any other last thoughts about this cool book?
No, I just thought, like, again, based on the times that we grew up and the things that we did when we were kids, I really felt at times like this book was written for me. Like, you know, I didn't get every reference in the book, but I got 90% of them or whatever.
Yeah, that's about me too.
And that, so I think that, you know, it's what part of what really made it appeal to me. But so it was all those references from my youth tied with a really cool story, gave it a lot of appeal.
Yeah, so. I totally agree. Yeah, it's a really good story, and then the references and everything. Well, let me put it this way. It's a really good story with good characters, A. B, it's well-constructed on top of that with those cool puzzles and mysteries to solve. and then C, sort of like spice or icing on the cake, are all the references. So that's just one layer of a much larger thing, and I was very impressed with it. And
also, like we talked about, the vision for the future of society in terms of how the internet is used and how, you know, people have reacted to, you know, what's going on in the rest of the world, the kind of the degradation of society while online culture continues to bloom. And that part I think was very interesting and very well done. And it's been a lot, and also the technical parts of the apparatus they use to interact with the internet stuff. He spent a lot of time thinking about that.
Yeah, because it's all stuff that's, maybe you can't do it right now, but you can so totally see it on the horizon.
100%.
Yeah.
Very believable, doable.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, we could keep talking for another 2 hours about it, but we're out of time. The rocket, as we say, is going to have to get on out of here for another week or two. John, I appreciate you coming on, and we'll hopefully try to get you back on again as usual in the future. We got to talk about some other books and things that we want to sort of dig into. So appreciate it. And
look forward to it. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. All right. Well, Rocket will get on out of here, and we will see you folks down the road.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.